Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The unemployment rate has passed 10% for the first time since 1983. An army psychiatrist is the suspect in a shooting rampage at Fort Hood Army Base that left 13 people dead. Republicans won the governor's mansions in Virginia and New Jersey, but a traditionally Republican congressional seat in New York went Democratic. And House Democrats push for support of their healthcare overhaul ahead of a vote scheduled for this weekend. Joining me for the domestic hour of our Friday news roundup, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times and PoliticsDaily.com, Glenn Thrush of Politico, and Jackie Carmes of the New York Times. Thank you all for joining me.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
We'll be opening the phones in just a while. The number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wmu.org. We'd love to have your questions and comments for this hour. Let's start, of course, with the events in Fort Hood. President Obama called the shootings a horrific outburst of violence. It is difficult enough to lose soldiers overseas, he said, but it is horrifying that they should lose their lives at an army base in the United States. Glenn, let me start with you. Who is the suspected gunman behind yesterday's shooting spree, and what do we know what happened about in Fort Hood?
Well, the suspected gunman is Major Nidal Malik Hassan, a 39-year-old psychiatrist with a really interesting and disturbing sort of trail behind him, including some comments that he had apparently made on some Islamic websites questioning the U.S. involvement in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and a pretty open discussion of his grave misgivings about being deployed overseas. He really seemed to be somebody who was sort of trapped between his Muslim beliefs and his responsibilities as an army psychiatrist. And it appears at the moment that he snapped and committed this horrific crime.
Lynn, is it too early to say that we have a motive emerging here?
Well, it is, because he has not been interviewed, and I guess you'd have to let the investigators have a shot at him. He's alive. He's in stable condition in the hospital, according to a press conference that the military had this morning in Fort Hood. But that doesn't mean that there won't be speculation. As Glenn mentioned, there's stuff out there to already think that there was some, you know, that this soldier was troubled. He had writings on his website that talked about some of his beliefs. You know, he had in an interview in the Washington Post, the paper talked to his aunt, and she said that he had talked about being harassed for his Muslim beliefs while in the military. So you have, at the outset, what seemed like a potentially combustible situation. Soldier who didn't want to be deployed, somebody who felt harassed in the military, but, and this is where it will be hard to reckon, somebody who had spent years and years in the military and, on top of it, was a mental health specialist.
Jackie Combs, as far as we know, he acted alone. There has been some speculation that some of the people who actually died might have actually been hit by bullets from police and soldiers who were trying to bring down the shooter. Is that right?
That's right. And you know, in the initial aftermath of this, there was a lot of reports. We saw, you know, multiple shooters and maybe conspirators with him, but it now seems pretty clear that he was alone. I think the biggest questions that will flow from this are, as, you know, the previous comments have alluded to, just what the Army knew about him and his problems, and when they knew it, and what they did, if anything, about it. And it's interesting, he's a graduate of Virginia Tech, where there was a horrific mass shooting in recent years, and Virginia Tech has been enduring since that time questions about why it didn't see some of the danger signs from the student that shot people there. So I think you'll have much the same.
Oh, absolutely. The internal control, the Department of Defense, I think, already, even if we don't know a lot about what happened, the idea that there was a potential lack of internal analysis on this person.
Okay, and Jackie,
question.
Jackie, what does this say to us about stress levels? Because as far as I understand it, Fort Hood is the largest American military installation in the world. It also sends more troops to Iraq than any other military installation. And according to a report in the Washington Post, it has the highest number of suicides of any army installation in the world.
And it also has, according to military brass, one of the most innovative programs now for dealing with that, probably, you know, inevitably as an outgrowth of the fact of its suicide rates and troubled veterans. Some of the people on that base have been through four deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that is just an incredible thing to consider. And
so stress levels are very high amongst
very
this population.
Very high. And so it's a sprawling place. I used to work in Texas and passed it often. And it's, you know, I just think this just underscores. This is not, we've all known and talked about and written about the high stress levels coming out of these this conflict, which, you know, goes back to civil war, any conflict. But the difference here is these repeat deployments that just exacerbate the stress.
Glenn, what does it mean for, do you think, Muslim soldiers potentially who are serving in the U.S. military, patriotic Muslim soldiers, and the kind of impact that this might have on them? We've already had Muslim communities in the country urging their constituents to be calm and trying to prevent some kind of a backlash against Muslim communities.
Well, clearly, I mean, CAIR, a group that represents Muslims nationally, was very quick out of the gate. In fact, I think one of the first press releases we got in our inbox was sort of this emphasizing people to take the details in stride. And clearly this individual was dealing with a conflict involving his identity as an American Muslim and his responsibilities as a soldier. But I think this also points out to a larger policy question that the Obama administration is addressing. I mean, we've heard from time and time again from the Pentagon and from Obama administration officials that the stresses on the forces in both Afghanistan and Iraq are extreme, and the deployments are stretched really thin. And I think it underscores, if the reports are correct, that this individual attempted to contact a lawyer so that he could potentially repay his medical training to the Army to get out of the deployment. I believe it just sort of underscores once again, the extreme need that the armed services have to field anybody that they possibly can. This guy apparently gave a lot of indications that he was not an ideal deployment.
Right, against the backdrop, of course, of all the discussions that are going on in the White House at the moment about the possibility of sending more troops to Afghanistan. We have an awful lot to get through this morning. Let's move on to the economy. Lynn Sweet, unemployment has now risen above 10% for the first time since October of 1983. It is more than economists have been predicting. How much more? And what does it say about, what do the current numbers say about the state of the economy?
Well, it says that there's no rebound. It says that the worry that the Obama White House had that it would miss, that the rate would go over 10 was true. And even though the White House has been trying to prepare people for 10, it's going to be a tough blow already. Republicans are out saying this just shows that the stimulus didn't work. And the Republicans are saying that this is just, you know, that the stimulus is just more debt, more spending, and has not shown anything. But when you look inside the numbers, there are a few things that you could find there, that non-farm payroll employment declined 190,000 jobs. But I think something like that will be overlooked, if nothing else, because the historic benchmark that this is, as you mentioned, the highest that we've seen since April of 93, and this is the highest since the recession in 2007. I mean, there are 15.7 million people who are unemployed in the country. The Obama administration marked, this week marked the year since Obama was elected, and perhaps people didn't expect the hope and change to happen this fast, but if you don't have a job, if people you know don't have a job, if your housing price hasn't stabilized, or if you can't sell your house, these are problems that the Obama White House cannot explain away.
Jackie Combs.
I think one thing that has to be noted, the 10.2% unemployment rate that we had in October was not unexpected. It's been said for months since the summer that it would probably peak in excess of 10% nationwide. And it's over 10% in a good number of the states right now. And 26 states are over 8.5% unemployment. One thing this shows in also this week, we had a very positive number on business productivity, one of the best in years. And what that tells you is it's a typical economic figure where good news means some bad news. The more productive businesses are, the less likely they are to hire new people, especially when they're not so sure where the economy is going right now. One other thing I'd like to note about this unemployment rate is this is a different time. I grew up in Northwest Ohio in a very manufacturing district. Lots, you know, often there were layoffs. And when people were laid off, they went back to work fairly soon, within the 26 weeks or 6 months that most states provide unemployment benefits. You now have a case where most people have been out of work for 6 months, and they're not going to go back to the jobs that they once had. And so it's a really different economic period right now. The Obama administration, as well as many economists, underestimated at the beginning of the year, thought unemployment would peak at 8%, and they vastly underestimated the private sector as well as the government, just how what a sort of transitional period we're at in our economy.
It's understandable, isn't it, Glenn, that people are getting confused by the economic numbers. My head's starting to spin. We have unemployment now over 10%. Meanwhile, the stock market is blooming. Banks are making record profits up on Wall Street. And, you know, there are others. And we had GDP growth, which was actually positive in the third quarter. So what are people to make of all of this confusion?
People hate uncertainty.
Me included.
Yeah. Ambiguity is death to incumbents. And what you're seeing is people are bobbing around in a sea of ambiguity right now. Just look at this unemployment report today. I mean, there is an underlying I heard a couple of economists say that the number peaked above 10% because more people are seeking work because they're more optimistic about the economy. And also some economists interpret the increased productivity number as sort of a latent demand for employees. So you can look at it both ways.
Okay, talking about uncertainty for incumbents, we're going to get on to the elections just after this short break. I'm joined in the studio by Jackie Carmes from The New York Times, by Glenn Thrush, who's with Politico. Lynn Sweet is here from the Chicago Sun-Times and PoliticsDaily.com. You've joined the Friday News Roundup. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined the Friday News Roundup. A lot to get through this hour. We have been speaking about the economy. We've been speaking, of course, about the tragic events at Fort Hood. Just before we move on to the elections this week, and we have lots of calls and comments already coming in on those elections. Jackie, I just wanted to ask you, the president is going to be making a speech in, what, an hour or so, looking at unemployment off the back of these numbers showing that unemployment has risen 10.2%. What's he going to say? What kind of help can he offer to those who are unemployed?
I think what he'll say, and what the administration officials have been consistently saying, is that we have come back from the abyss of financial ruin, and the economy shows every sign that it started growing, but it's not enough. They pair every statement about the progress in the recovery with the fact that he will not rest until every American who wants a job can find a job.
Is he going to extend unemployment insurance?
He will sign that bill if he hasn't done so already. And I should say, you know, what's lost, it's an extension of 14 to 20 weeks, depending on your state's unemployment rate. And that brings the maximum total that a long-term unemployed person could get to 99 weeks, nearly 2 years of unemployment benefits. And that is just unprecedented.
Okay, let's get on to the elections. We've already got emails and comments coming in about this week's off-year elections. Of course, on Tuesday, when the Republicans won the governorships in New Jersey and in Virginia, when the Democrats won a seat in upstate New York that traditionally has gone Republican. Here is Bryce writing us from Washington, D.C. How do two victories in two special elections constitute an Election Day setback for House Democrats. The Republicans did indeed capture two state houses, but please don't jump on the all-or-nothing bandwagon as the media usually does after an election. That's all of us. And characterise the day as a total unmitigated disaster for Democrats. There were major victories on both sides. Glenn Thrush is Bryce Wright.
I think it was a mitigated disaster for Democrats. No, I totally...
Nancy Pelosi called it a victory, though.
Well, okay for her. It was clearly a roadmap for defeat for both parties. In the two gubernatorial races, you had two weak, wounded candidates in states that have a lot of anxiety about the economy and have a propensity for voting against sort of a national trend to begin with. In New York 23, the race that Owens won against Doug Hoffman, the conservative candidate, that really exposed a very significant fissure between the moderates in the GOP and the conservative right wing. Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh supported the conservative candidate and helped force out Didi Scozzafava, a pro-choice, pro-gay marriage candidate. So I think the takeaway from both of those elections are that both parties still have a great capacity to screw up.
And perhaps worth noting that Congressman-elect Owens will be meeting the president this afternoon in the White House. Clearly the White House wanting to focus on that little bit of good news.
And has signaled he will vote for the public option health care bill in the House.
Lynn Sweet, let's talk a little bit about Virginia and particularly about Republicans, because Virginia seems to be, of all of these races, perhaps the most important, the one from which we can extrapolate the most nationally. It was a state, of course, that had voted for Obama, voted a big swing for McDonnell, the Republican, in this race. What are the Republicans drawing from that experience there?
Well, the Republicans can claim a comeback because of the victory not only of the governorship, but of some of the down-ballot races. Now, can you take from that the Democrats are in trouble in 2010 and for the next presidential election? Not clear. I think what is emerging is that perhaps the Obama campaign was a singular experience, very unique in American history, and that the way the campaign was run, the movement aspects of it, which none of this, by the way, existed in Virginia, New Jersey, or in New York 23rd Congressional District, which we talked about. So it's not as if American politics changed top to bottom with the election of Obama. There still are local issues and local candidates weak and strong. And as Glenn mentioned, we had a very weak Democratic candidate almost from the beginning. He was running an uphill battle. So I think the lesson you have is that nothing is permanent in American politics.
And the Obama army, what happened to them? Where were they in this campaign?
They didn't get jazzed up. Now, the Obama army list lives in the Democratic National Committee. It's been renamed the Organizing for America instead of Obama for America. And the phenomenon that's taking place there is that the Organizing for America folks have to keep these people jazzed up, engrossed, have a party in your living room for the health care bill and then have another one for the climate change bill. People are frustrated. It's a lot easier to go in and sell a candidate on big macro positions and hope and change, and then to say, come to my house, Katie, and I want to talk to you about the health bill. And you'll say, is that Section 12? That really bothers me, Lynn. What do you have to say about it? So that army is not easily transferable to other candidates. It is being used to rally around the country to help pass Obama's agenda.
Jackie, it seems also that from these elections, one thing we can draw from Tuesday is a kind of that there is this very strong, listen, sweep them all out, get rid of a bunch of them.
That's
mood
right.
Going on in the country. Nobody's happy with what's happening in Washington. They're not happy with their leadership. If you are in power at the moment, you are in a weak position just by virtue of the fact that you're not getting much done.
That's absolutely right. And if you, when you interview some of the people in these groups, the teabag groups and others, they will tell you that they are, you know, as fed up with the Republican incumbents, maybe not as much as the Democrats, but a good deal. And they feel like they are a sort of third force. The enthusiasm, though, is on the conservative side, and that's beneficial to Republicans, of course. But I do think you can overinterpret these Tuesday election results and draw conclusions that are not going to be important a year from now when the midterm elections are held. The biggest thing is this unemployment number. And the danger there is, and that's what's behind
a lot of the candidates were not addressing.
Exactly. And you have to, as long as the unemployment rate remains high and people are continuing to lose jobs, and we see this recovery on Wall Street and financial institutions pulling down both big profits and big bonuses, that is going to be a problem. And the real problem here is the last two recessions, the early 90s and early in this decade, were unlike any other recession we've had in that once the economy started growing again, there was a huge lag time before employers started hiring again, as much as 19 months after the growth. That would mean that since the growth started, we think, and the recession probably ended several months ago, we could well be still losing jobs on Election Day 2010.
And that's the real estate market still might not have a comeback. That's why you cannot underestimate that those two factors, the impact it will have, because real people could see it every day.
Right. Let's go to the phones to Michael in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Michael, thank you for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. Yeah. Thank you for taking the call. I think the press is really getting this supposed civil war in the Republican Party all wrong. It's really a matter of not is there any room for moderates in the party, are there any room for liberal Democrats in the party? I mean, if you look at what Skozafada believed in, she was pro-Karchek, pro-gay marriage, not pro-life. She voted for the stimulus bill. There was no distinguishing her from not even a moderate Democrat from a liberal Democrat. If you look at the McDonald race, McDonald and Deeds went at it during the last election, and McDonald only won by 300 votes. McDonald, everybody knows in Virginia who McDonald is and what he is. So the Democrats control everything in the House and the Senate, and they're tying themselves up in knots trying to get the support for it. So, you know, I think it's wishful thinking by the press that there's this massive civil war. Yeah, there's no room for liberals in the Republican Party, nor is there really room for conservatives in the Democratic Party, and that's what the parties are about. So,
okay, I'm going to put that to Glenn Thrush, who's joining me in the studio from Politico. Glenn, are the press overplaying the divisions within the Republican Party between moderates and conservatives?
I don't think it's wishful thinking by the press. I think it's strategic thinking by Republican leaders. This take on this schism isn't coming from reporters. It's coming from Republicans who tell us that they are extraordinarily concerned that the party is sort of shutting down for moderates. I mean, I ran into Olympia Snow in the Senate a couple of days ago after Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota said that she would be in trouble with Republicans for, quote unquote, deviating from acceptable GOP norms. And Olympia Snow said, look, I've been a Republican all of my life. And I think I am the model for what the party needs to be. Republican leaders, not reporters, are saying that the attitude of sort of keeping moderates out or alienating them is a real recipe to stay at 28 or 30% of the electorate.
But I've also spoken to Republicans, Lynn Sweet, during the last couple of days since the election, who have said to me that Republicans that want to get elected to office should be looking at the McDonnell model.
Well, maybe, maybe not. I think, again, it depends on how moderate their record might be. There's a story I did this week about a House member running for Senate in Illinois. His name is Mark Kirk. He's known as a moderate's moderate, comes from a Democratic-leaning district. Now that he's running statewide, of all things, he wrote a letter to Sarah Palin, who's going to be in Chicago later this month to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and he asked her for supportive comments for his candidacy. Well, that memo leaked out. It touched off a bit of a firestorm because he was attacked then from the conservatives, who said that shows you're not trustworthy. And then, of course, all the Democratic contenders, and this is for the what's known now in Illinois as the Obama Senate seat. It says you're pandering to the right. So he's moving right to the right for a Republican primary. He's now afraid of, I guess, some kind of a conservative threat in the primary, though his opponents are nominal. So first of all, to the caller, I don't think we're, and this is a case where we're following a story, I don't think making it up at all. We're reporting on very significant developments within the Republican Party.
Okay, there's a lot more calls and questions on that. I want to get back to that in a minute, but let's move on to healthcare legislation because this is going to be a very busy week. Glenn Thrush has already told me he's cancelled all his personal plans for the weekend. The president is going to be going to the Hill. The House is expected to vote on healthcare overhaul legislation. Give us a sense of what's going on this over the next couple of days, what's been happening in the last couple of days, the significant developments on this.
Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said yesterday that she is confident that she has the 218 votes, but doesn't have them right now. A couple of problems seem to have cropped up in the last 24 hours. One is the Congressional Hispanic Caucus is objecting over the strengthening of language against illegal immigration, which is something that conservative Blue Dog Democrats and others have demanded. And we still have not had any resolution of this question that about 40 conservative members have with regard to strengthening anti-abortion language. They don't want any federal money going for abortion. And the pro-choice community says that they don't want to see the health care bill being used as a de facto constitutional amendment against abortion. I don't believe either of those two issues are intractable, but we are going to see an arm-twisting extravaganza the likes we haven't seen since the stimulus or climate change bill.
I'm Catty Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And do join us. 1-800-433-8850 is the number. You can also email us at drshow@wamu.org. Jackie Calm's extraordinary scenes on Capitol Hill yesterday with both supporters of the bill inside, opponents of the bill outside. For a moment, it looked like the place and the job to have was to be a Capitol Hill reporter for the day yesterday.
Yeah, it was quite a circus and you know, the best sort of day to be covering Capitol Hill.
People being dragged out of Joe Lieberman's office, people being dragged out of Nancy Pelosi's office.
Arrested. And it just shows the passions that are at work on this issue. And I think we'll see some of that through the weekend. You know, you hearken back to August when we had these town halls that a lot of us were writing about. And there's no question that this will continue through Christmas, because now we're hearing or assuming that this health care bill won't be final until after this year.
Lynn Sweet, how important was the endorsement of the AARP and the AMA for the Democrats' health care?
It was important enough that President Obama himself came into the press briefing room yesterday to talk it up. And that doesn't happen that often. So if nothing else, that tells you the administration thinks it's important. The elderly are among the most significant voters in the United States because they vote. And any time you talk about Medicare, it's called the third rail of American politics. You don't touch it. And there are provisions in the bill that do deal with Medicare, from reimbursement rates to doctors, which a lot of people don't think about, because if you're on Medicare and you can't get in to see an internist who you want to because they don't want their practice filled up with, in a sense, patients who are cost losers for them, you know, it's a problem. So to get that stamp of approval from AARP is a big deal in trying to mollify the senior citizen concerns. And the AMA means that you have a buy-in from doctors, and that at least quiets some dissonance. So it is important not only for who it helps, but the voices that you won't hear from now.
Okay, let's go to Steve in St. Louis, Missouri. Steve, you're on the air. Thank you for joining the program.
Yeah, hi. I was following some of the protests that were going on in D.C. yesterday, and I thought it was interesting because my congressman, Todd Akin, was very active in that protest. And in the district congressional district I come from is a pretty moderate suburb, but that has for a rather long time been a Republican seat. You know, pretty much any Republican could hold that, but Akin is really kind of an unassuming and guy who doesn't really stick out that much. So I found it really interesting that a Republican incumbent who could be challenged in the future was latching on to this very bombastic, you know, outspoken language. And it seems to me that could be a problem for the incumbents that, you know, they're going to have to show the beef to the people out on the ground, or the people who are trying to protest are going to be pretty irritated that it seems like people are trying to co-opt their message.
Steve, very good point. Glenn Thrush.
I think the caller hits the nail right on the head. I mean, it was about 2 months ago, I had conversations with leadership aides in the House Republicans, and they were telling me how embarrassed they were by Michelle Bachmann, the conservative from Minnesota who led this stuff, and Virginia Fox, a conservative from North Carolina, who trumpeted the death panels. So it was pretty fascinating.
Not to mention Joe Wilson.
And Joe Wilson. It was fascinating to see all the leadership of that, all the fairly moderate leadership. Mike Castle, who's running for Senate in Delaware, who's a very moderate guy, went up there and spoke. So it was pretty interesting watching all the leaders trumping up there to kiss the ring.
And presumably after Tuesday, we have a situation where a lot of congressmen and women are looking at what's happening in this healthcare legislation, Glenn, and trying to position themselves.
And also how to figure out, I think there's a real puzzle on how to figure out how to harness the energy of the Tea Party movement without falling prey to some of its embarrassments and alienating independents.
Okay, you've joined the Friday News Roundup. I'm joined here in the studio by Glenn Thrush. He's congressional reporter for Politico. Jackie Carnes, national correspondent with the New York Times, is also with me, as is Lynn Sweet, Washington bureau chief with the Chicago Sun-Times and a columnist at politicsdaily.com. The number here is 1-800-433-8850. You can also send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. It's been a busy week. Do send us your questions and comments. We're going to take a quick break. Stay listening.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Iranian protesters clash with government forces on the 30th anniversary of the U.S. hostage crisis, plus reaction to Secretary Clinton's Middle East trip, a panel of journalists on these stories and the rest of the week's top international news. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our Friday News Roundup, and Ed Tim from St. Louis, Missouri, has written in to us. How can you claim that we do not understand the shooter's motive? This is, of course, an email about the shooting in Fort Hood in Texas. How can you claim that we do not understand the shooter's motive when we know of his expressed political views, his published web musings, and his Islamic proclamation at the time of the shooting? You insist that we cannot call this terrorism. I don't actually think anyone did insist that, but I'm baffled as to how it can be thought of as anything else. That's Ed Tim. Lynn, do you want to take that on?
The reason, Tim, that I, and I think if I could try to speak for all of us, we're holding out conclusions in reservation is that we are not covering the story firsthand. We have read and heard what you have too, and sometimes you don't need everybody to jump to a conclusion. There may be other facts out there that we don't know. Certainly everything you say is on the trail to the conclusion that you seem to have arrived at. I just think this is a horrific, horrible incident in American life, and rather than make a proclamation as to somebody's motives, we might actually hear from this person. So I will wait a little bit before opining. Right.
I think it's, you know, it's typical journalism. You put out all the facts. He knows, like we do, about the man's activities to date because the press has put them out there to draw, and readers can draw conclusions. One reason I don't think people want to, speculate about motives is because an act this horrendous, you often think, can only be the act of a very deranged person. And, you know, maybe there is no motive other than he just snapped mentally.
And everyone is always wrong. I mean, if you've covered stuff as a reporter, and we've all covered these violent episodes, stuff that comes out in the first 24 to 48 hours is always wrong. For instance, if we had drawn conclusions from yesterday, we would have thought there were three other shooters and that the gunman was dead and so was a cop down there. So I think you have to wait till the facts come out before you draw conclusions.
Right. And we have also, during the course of this program, of course, focused both on the kinds of things that he's been writing on his website, and we focused on the stress levels at Fort Hood as well, which may be part of the motivation too. So I think there's a lot of complicated factors, and it is worth waiting before any of us says that we are clear about a motive. Let's go to Bob in Roanoke, Virginia. Bob, you've joined the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The issue I called in about was the health care bill.
Mm-hmm.
My question goes to the leadership of the Democrat Party as to why the new rules, which are rules only when the Democrats don't want them to be the new rules, and that is the 72-hour review of any bill before it is voted on. Last time I noticed, now till midnight tomorrow night doesn't constitute 72 hours anyway, and the bill isn't even completed at this point. So how can Madam Pelosi have any credibility in this matter? Second is on AARP. I currently am a member for a while longer until my membership runs out. Then I'll join another organization who actually might listen to their people and constituency instead of looking out for their own bottom line, because all they're looking for is to try to make their insurance holdings look good instead of trying to avoid the 400 and some odd billion dollar cuts to Medicare that are coming in this bill.
Okay.
If there are that many cuts, if there are that much savings in Medicare, why aren't they doing them now?
Okay, Bob, I'm going to put your comments and your question to Lynn Sweet.
On the 72-hour review, it is a disappointment that the House leadership doesn't let bills sit a few days so people could read them. And it just doesn't have to be that way. Part of what you're going to see this weekend, by the way, is a lot of this, as Glenn talked about, horse wrangling and arm trading. There might be some changes and revisions. But we have so many ways to put bills out to people now. It's called the Internet, and the leaders know it. And I think it's just a sad point that they can't do more to put these bills online sooner and
okay.
Let them sit so people can have time to read them. By the way, even for these big, massive, complicated bills, wasn't the melded version like 1,990
pages?
And last night we just had the introduction of about 150 amendments that will be considered. They are on the Rules Committee website of the House for people that want to check.
And I'll be impressed with anyone who reads all of that. We should also point out, of course, that this week the Republicans presented their own health care plan as well. What did the Congressional Budget Office say about the Republican plan, Jackie Combs?
It concluded that they would only expand insurance coverage to a relatively few millions of uninsured Americans.
12 million, I think it is, isn't it?
Three.
It was much.
Sorry, it's 12. The Democrats' plan will cover 12 times as many.
Right, exactly.
As the Republican plan.
And that it will cost roughly $60 billion as opposed to the much higher price tag for the Democrats' bill. But the Republicans, you know, there was a lot of debate in their party about whether they should have a bill at all, and just, the people who wanted to have something won out. But they wanted to do it in an incremental way. It would be very few changes, relatively speaking, in the way things are done, and they, including the fact that they left out a provision that would require insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing medical conditions. So, but there was enough feeling that they were, you know, the polls have shown that the Republicans are not, are losing ground because they're seen as obstructionists. So they wanted to have something to point to.
And Glenn, I've had a couple of Republicans this week say to me that they feel their party has not behaved responsibly during this process, that they should have been out there with a plan much earlier.
Well, that's the big debate. But the political perils of having a plan out there, a lot of them felt outweighed the benefits. For instance, I think it was this morning or yesterday, the Times, your paper, Jackie, just blasted this plan and said it was a charade and that it completely ignored the shameful issue of the estimated, I guess the estimates are now 30 million uninsured Americans. So that was always the calculation. Do you get out there with a plan that people can snipe at, or do you just get characterized as being the party of no?
Well, here's why it was important for Republicans to do it, charade or not, because what happens in these local campaigns when lawmakers go in back for re-election or their challengers are out there, it lets a Republican say, I'm for health care reform. I'm for the Republican plan, House bill number, whatever. So you can't tell me I'm against health care. We just have a difference of opinion of the best way to go. That's what that's about. And I see why Republicans did it. Remember, as we all do, that no significant Obama legislation has passed with Republicans on a roll call. Why will this one be different?
How much pressure are House leaders under to allow their legislators to go back to their districts at the moment? Because it looks like, Glenn, as you were saying, not only this weekend, but we're going to be working hard into the holidays. The timetable is looking very crammed, and yet all of these legislators need to get back to their districts to listen to their constituents. And, of course, to watch out for those elections next year.
Well, they never like being in Washington to begin with. You know, I'm sure some reporters would join them in that characterization. But I think particularly now when people are starting to run ads in districts, they feel much more comfortable being at home to defend themselves. And I think, you know, that's the paradox here. They need to be here to make the laws, and then they need to go home to defend themselves. So it's uncomfortable.
Okay, let's go back to the phones to Jerry, who is calling us from O'Fallon, Missouri. Jerry, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. Thank
morning.
You. Morning. I voted for Gerald Ford in the first presidential election I was eligible to vote in with two pro-choice candidates. And what I've seen is, I guess to counter the first caller, the Republican Party move away from the party of William F. Buckley and true conservatism. I kind of think they signed a deal with the devil to bring all these social conservatives on board, which, frankly, I think that term is kind of an oxymoron. And I think the election in upstate New York may be a precursor for the fact that in order to win the Republican nomination, someone will have to pander so far to the, I won't even call it conservative, you know, because the social issues, I think, are anti-conservative, so far to that crowd that they will not be electable in a general election. Thank you.
Okay, Jackie Combs, big debate going on in the Republican Party at the moment.
There is. And, you know, it's not just in the races we looked at this week. You know, across the country, there are incumbent Republicans or Republicans seeking another office who are being challenged. Charlie Crist in Florida,
right.
The governor, is trying to come to the Senate, but he's having to make peace with the conservatives in the party who think he's far too moderate. And one that's been under the radar all the way across the country in Utah, incumbent Senator Robert Bennett, by anybody's estimation, a conservative Republican, he is being challenged in that party primary very strongly. And the biggest sin he seems to have committed in the minds of some who are consider themselves more conservative than him is that he co-sponsored a health care reform bill with a Democrat, Senator Wyden of Oregon. And these are people, these conservatives who are unhappy with him, who don't want compromise of any kind with the other party.
Okay, we've talked a lot about the economy, and of course unemployment has hit 10%, over 10%. That announcement came out today. There was also a key vote in the House, a House committee voting to give the Securities and Exchange Commission more power this week, Glenn Thrush. We sometimes have ignored, I think, the importance to the White House of regulating the financial system. It has been a key part of President Obama's plans for the economy. But as we talk about unemployment and we talk about the housing market and we talk about joblessness, sometimes we forget about the regulatory side. And this is another.
It's a huge issue for the Democrats on the Hill as well as the White House, because the Democratic majorities in both houses were largely financed by Wall Street fundraising, investment banking fundraising, facilitated by Rahm Emanuel, who was then in the House and is now the White House Chief of Staff, and Chuck Schumer in the Senate. So it is very important, particularly to compromise members such as Chris Dodd in Connecticut, to sort of clean themselves up on regulatory reform. And the House took a small first step in doing that. They passed this a bill through Barney Frank's committee to beef up the regulatory authority of the SEC, and that is really a precursor for the larger regulatory reform issues. The problem is there is great disagreement among Democrats. Barney Frank is having some conflict with Henry Waxman, another powerful member of the House, and he's also having some conflict with Dodd on the contours of the larger financial regulatory structure. So it is something that cuts both ways. It exposes schisms within the Democratic Party, yet it is also something that is extraordinarily vital for Democrats to run on next year so that they can say that they did something to prevent the next collapse.
Jackie.
This matter of the Securities and Exchange Commission getting the resources it needs and the power it needs to sufficiently regulate financial institutions and markets is very important. I mean, in the forensic journalism that's being done now about why this a financial crash happened, one of the biggest places to look is the SEC. And throughout, in the years before last year, I was working at the Wall Street Journal here in town, and the Wall Street Journal in that time had story after story throughout this decade under the Bush administration and frankly, Republicans for the first 6 years in charge of Congress, where the SEC asked year after year for more funds and year after year was turned down. And it was a combination of that and a sort of free market deregulatory atmosphere that, you know, infected Democrats as well. Under former SEC head Chris Cox, a former free market Republican congressman from California, that, you know, a lot of these, the lack of oversight and regulation of what turned out to be abusive practices occurred.
And Bernie Madoff, in a jailhouse interview, really described toying with these young SEC investigators like they were, you know, mice.
I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And do call us. 1-800-433-8850 is the number here. Our email address is drshow@wmu.org. Let's go back to the phones to Maxine in Delray Beach, Florida. Maxine, thanks for joining the program.
Hello, thank you. I heard very early this morning on All Things Considered that a classmate of the alleged shooter in medical school had told a story about they were doing grand rounds, and that's where a student is supposed to present a case, and there are students present and there are professors present. And instead of presenting a case, this man gave a speech about Islam. And during this speech, he said that non-believers should be beheaded and that oil should be poured down the throats of non-believers. So other Muslims in the auditorium spoke up and said, well, no, that's not right. That's not Islam. That's your personal view.
Okay, Maxine, I'm going to hold it there. We have just a couple of minutes left on the program. This is not something I heard. Maxine says she heard it on All Things Considered. Anyone else hear this morning?
No, but that's why I just counsel. Let facts come out, and there's going to be a lot of interviews from people who knew him, and let's just see what his psychological portrait really was.
Before we jump to conclusions about any sort of motive.
Yes.
Glenn?
I did hear it this morning, you know, and it's just one more, you know, one more bit of evidence. And I agree with Lynn. We should just wait and see what happens.
But there's clearly going to be a lot of questions asked, not only about this particular individual, I think more broadly, but about the levels of stress in the army, the levels of stress for people who have faced the prospect of being sent abroad. And how much do you think, Jackie, this event is going to have an impact on discussions that are going on in the White House at the moment in terms of sending more troops over to Afghanistan? Because we've had several things being delayed this week. We have the prospect of delays on several issues from the White House, but the Afghan resolution is one of them.
It's hard for me to believe that this will have a big impact on the decision the president is facing about whether to send, well, not whether to send more troops to Afghanistan, but really how many more to send and what their charge will be. But it's definitely got to be an ongoing concern as they go forward, because you can't, if you're going to ramp up, you've got to figure out where you cannot keep sending back the same people who haven't been here long enough to recover.
But moreover than that, though, it does show that if this guy did have telltale warning signs, it might be that the other question is just why didn't the system catch him?
Right.
No matter, and this could be independent of a troop buildup or anything. So this will raise questions about the Department of Defense and their procedures for just catching people who should not be in the positions they're in.
And I suspect it's also going to shine a spotlight, as has already been done, but perhaps needs to be done a little bit more, on the kind of stress levels that we are seeing at Fort Hood in particular. Thank you very much for joining me, all three of you. Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief for Chicago Sun-Times and PoliticsDaily.com, a columnist there. Glenn Thrush from Politico. Jackie Carms, National Correspondent of the New York Times. Thanks for joining me for the Friday News Roundup.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC. I've been sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.